The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Claire Armistead, and this is the Guardian Books Podcast. This week, we're reinterpreting the classics with contrasting approaches to Greek myth from Stephen Fry and Emily Wilson. From Alexander Pope to T.E. Lawrence, from Samuel Butler to Robert Graves, there's one thing linking every translator who has sailed the wine-dark sea of Homer's Odyssey. They're all men, or at least they were until now. Emily Wilson joins Charlotte Higgins in the studio to explore how gender complicates the story of Homer's complicated man. But first, we talk to Stephen Fry, who brings his own brand of English drollery with footnotes to those stories we thought we all knew. Mythos, a retelling of the myths of ancient Greece, sees QI's inquisitorial brain box interrogating received readings of Zeus, Apollo and all that crew, as well as prizing open the lid of Pandora's jar. Surely that should be a box. Well, no, actually, as he revealed when he came into the Guardian studios.
Through the window of her bedroom, the moonlight shone down on the garden. The sundial's gnomon gleamed like a silver blade. And once again she thought she heard the music of the jar. Epimetheus was sleeping happily beside her. The moonbeams danced in the garden. Unable to stand it any longer, Pandora leapt from her matrimonial bed and was out in the garden, unrolling the base of the sundial and scrabbling at the earth before she had time to tell herself that this was the wrong thing to do. She pulled the jar from its hiding place and twisted at the lid. Its waxen seal gave way, and she pulled it free. There was a fast fluttering, a furious flapping of wings, and a wild wheeling and whirling in her ears. Oh, glorious flying creatures! But no, they were not glorious at all. Pandora cried out in pain and fright as she felt something leathery brush her neck, followed by a sharp and terrible prick of pain as some sting or bite pierced her skin. More and more flying shapes buzzed from the mouth of the jar, a great cloud of them chattering, screaming, and howling in her ears. Through the swirling fog of these dreadful creatures, she saw the face of her husband as he came outside to see what was happening. It was white with horror and fright. With a great cry, Pandora summoned up the courage and strength to close the lid and seal the jar. On the garden wall, in the shape of a wolf, Zeus looked on, smiling the most terrible and wicked smile, as, like a cloud of locusts, the shrieking, wailing creatures clawed the air and circled the garden below them in a great vortex before flying up and away over the town, over the countryside, and around the world, settling like a pestilence wherever man had habitation. And what were they, these shapes? They were mutant descendants of the dark and evil children of both Nyx and Erebus. They were born of Apate, deceit, Geras, old age, Oisis, misery, Momos, blame, Keres, violent death. They were the offshoots of Arte, ruin, and Eris, discord. These were their names: Ponos, hardship, Limos, starvation, Algos, pain, Dysnomia, anarchy, Pseudia, lies, Nikia, quarrels, Amphilogiae, disputes, Machai, wars, Hisminae, battles, Androctasiae and Phonoi, manslaughters and murders. Illness, violence, deceit, misery and want had arrived. They would never leave the earth. What Pandora did not know was that when she shut the lid of the jar so hastily, she forever imprisoned inside one last daughter of Nyx, one last little creature was left behind to beat its wings hopelessly in the jar forever. Its name was Elpis. Hope.
So, Stephen.
Claire.
Lots and lots of thoughts were going through my mind as I heard that. One of which is, oh my goodness, it's Harry Potter. No, leathery wings flying around, magic creatures hosting. Obviously, you are the voice of Harry Potter, partly for a lot of people.
Yes, that's true, I suppose. Well, if you have to be generic about such things, I suppose it's children's fiction, obviously, and to an extent, people would use the word fantasy fiction, as they might of J.R.R. Tolkien or George R.R. Martin, for example, who are very popular. And I suppose the difference with myth is that it isn't singly authored in the way that such things are. But they have in common, I suppose, a completeness of their world. And that's what so attracts me to Greek myth, is that although it is like all myths, you know, if you want to be kind of James Frazier about it, it's, you know, a collective unconscious expression of all kinds of impulses, and is both, I suppose, the grand word is etiological. It you know, it suggests the causes of things, why there are volcanoes or earthquakes, and where the storms come from, and so on. But also, it dramatizes human emotion, and what's special about Greek myth in particular, I think, is that. Although it led eventually to a kind of codification that might be called religious in Greece, it's not a religion. It doesn't tell you how to behave. There are no commandments. The only commandments are in the morals of the stories, if you choose to take them. Examples of hubris punished and lust frustrated and so on. And you can say that those kind of are teachers, but that's not the purpose. There's nothing preachy about the Greeks. That's one of the things I adore about them.
And in your introduction, you say that what you want to do with this is just tell the story.
Yes, I think it's very exciting for readers to make sort of leaps or see things inside the myths and to sort of, within the wonderful glow of the story, to discern a kind of meaning or a suggestion of a connection which the reader makes. So, for example, I've always loved the fact that, you know, one of the original titans was the titaness Mnemosyne, which is Greek for memory. And by Zeus, she had 9 daughters, each of whom represented one of the arts, the muses. But there's something, if you want to think about it, rather marvellous about a myth structure that says the arts are the daughters of memory. And that's actually saying something. It's not just we'll make them the daughters of this nymph or this titaness. It seems to have something very profound. And yet it's not my job as telling the myth to point people in that direction. I hope people leap upon it themselves.
But you do, don't you? Because you also have this sort of wonderful dressing of footnotes, and then you have an appendix.
yes, what a classicist would call an apparatus criticus. I think because I had such fun researching it, and there are, particularly I enjoy the little etymological journeys that certain words have taken, or gods and the words of gods. You know, obviously, it's particularly the Roman, the Latin versions of the gods' names that we have in our language. So we say Mercurial of Mercury, who is Hermes, or Jovial of Jove, who is Jupiter, who is Zeus, of course, and Saturnine of Saturn, who is Kronos, and Martial of Mars, as in the martial arts, and so on. And so I love all that. I also like... it's very interesting to me that Hestia, who's one of the least known of the Olympian deities, original Olympian deities, who was Vesta to the Romans, as in the Vestal Virgins, who were the sort of original nuns, really, the celibate females who kept the flame going, or the original sort of guardians of the sacred flame. She was goddess of the hearth. And to us, we think, well, that's a strange thing to be a goddess of. But actually, of course, language teaches us that the hearth has a really important place in human history and human culture. In fact, the word hearth and the word heart, the Anglo-Saxon, are cognate. And the Greek word for hearth is cardia, as in cardiac. It's also heart. The Latin for hearth is focus.
And that also
speaks for itself, doesn't it?
And that brings us back to, let's just go back to this passage. Epimetheus is the brother of Prometheus.
Yes, and
Prometheus who introduced fire, therefore made hearths possible.
Exactly, that's right. So, and the marvellous thing, Prometheus is, some people have compared him to Christ, of course, and certainly the Romantics thought of Prometheus as the most important figure in all myth. That the moment the shackles of ecclesiasticism were sort of shaken off in the Enlightenment and the Romantic period began, Beethoven wrote a Prometheus overture, and of course the great Mary Shelley at the age of 20 wrote the novel Frankenstein, which is subtitled The Modern Prometheus, and her husband Percy Shelley wrote Prometheus Unbound because And suddenly they were able to see that what the Greeks had suggested was that humankind had the divine spark, that a champion of mankind, an immortal himself, Prometheus, had stolen fire from heaven, both the literal fire that gave us the ability to have hearths and to smelt and to forge and to make ceramics and to cook food and to frighten away animals and to, you know, basically to advance our civilization, but also the divine inner fire, the fire that makes us creative and puts us equal to gods. And for the Greeks, Zeus did not want us to have that fire, but Prometheus did, and Zeus was so angry he punished him, and he lay with his arms out, like in a kind of crucifixion, on the Caucasus Mountains, and had his liver pecked away every day, and being immortal it would grow back, until eventually, much later in the sort of timeline of Greek myths, Hercules or Heracles rescues him. And you know, I've been thinking a lot about this, Claire, lately, because thanks to Darwin and other scientists, we can be fairly certain, I think, that we were not intelligently designed by gods, but we can be equally certain that by the end of this century, there will be sapient beings on this planet who have been intelligently designed by us. The convergence of artificial intelligence, machine learning, biotech, and robotics will ensure this. And so we have the choice. Are we going to be like Prometheus? Will we grant these sapient beings our inner fire? In other words, consciousness and a kind of autonomy in their sapience? Or will we be like Zeus and deny it them?
So before even Prometheus has a chance to offer himself up as a you know, in apology for what he's done, Zeus has taken everything out on his poor old brother by sending Pandora and her jar to mm-hmm. us. Why do you have it as a jar? There are lots of little, tiny little details which I think are intriguing. You don't ever explain why you say jar rather than box.
There is a footnote, actually. I do explain that it became a box as a mistranslation by, of all people, the great scholar and humanist Erasmus, translating from Hesiod, translated pithos into pixos, and so jar into box, and so it became. He was translating from Greek into Latin, in fact. So he put it the Latin for box, and it became box. But in the original, I say original, of course, you know, there were no witnesses to Pandora, but Hesiod, stroke Hesiod, depending how you like your long Greek E's, he claimed it was a jar.
So. And there's another detail, the Promethean detail, which I really love, which is Promethean stealing the fire with a giant fennel.
Yes, a fennel stalk. That's
a giant fennel stalk.
Yeah, there's something very pleasing about. It's very typical of Greek that there's always this specificity about things, and you can't be quite sure why fennel, what fennel represents, or is fennel a good, you know, vector of flame? You know, he dips it into the flame on Olympus, and the glow lights the pith of the fennel stalk. So it's an interesting question. But it's always represented, isn't there? You know, there are artists and other poets who've written about Prometheus who've always included the fennel. I remember for a time when I was a teenager, I wondered if it was connected to the fact that the Italian slang for a gay person, a rather rude slang, is fennocchio, which is fennel in Italian. And I got so interested to try and find out why Italian. And I thought, is there something phallic about a fennel stalk, as far as I can tell? And
of course, sin.
Well, actually, apparently, it's a horrible reason, and this is one of the explanations as to why fennel stalk, why Finocchio means gay person, is that when they burned gay men in Italy, I guess under the time of Savonarola and around that period, in order to moderate the appalling stench of human burning flesh, they threw fennel onto the fire in order to kind of improve the aroma.
Well, this is just so typical of you, isn't it? That here we are talking about Greek myths and we've arrived at Italians burning gays and quenching the smell with fennel.
Well, it's lovely. I do love those sort of leaps. It could be regarded as a lack of concentration or something, but I do, like a chamois, like to leap from crag to crag, and it can take one to odd places. But that's, of course, an enormous pleasure that's been added to by the internet. And in as much as I thought of Prometheus and the development of artificial intelligence and sapient life forms that are going to come at the end of the century, it also reminded me of of how enamoured I was with the internet when it first arrived. In the very late 80s, I had an email address, and then in the 90s, slowly, as things emerged, like the World Wide Web in 94 kind of time, I began to think that this internet, this new way of people connecting, was like Pandora, which means in Greek the all-gifted. It was all-gifted. All art, all knowledge, science, education, cultural exchange was possible. And then the social media arrived and the Arab Spring, and I thought, you know, there can be no more tyrants. We will now understand each other in a way we never have before. This all-gifted internet is going to melt away the barriers and dissolve the horror of nativism, tribalism, rivalry, and nationalism, all the nasty things are going to fade away. And at some point, of course, that lid opened and out came the trolls and the abusers and the groomers and the thieves and the malicious and the hideous and the fascist and the suppressive and the lying. And, you know, if anything were a Pandora's box, it were the internet.
Who is your intended reader for this book? Because I was really intrigued, because you've written it in a... It's incredibly learned. It has all this learnedness that you've shown in the studio. But it's written in a very, very jaunty, down-to-earth, comic way.
Well, I think that... I'm sort of obviously very keen that people realise myths don't belong in the schoolroom. That the, you know, we sort of picture almost Victorian gowned schoolmasters and a sort of thin rain of chalk dust. And Odysseus went to the island of, you know, and you think, oh Lord, these are tales told in lands of sunlight and food and, you know, love and nymphs. And, you know, they're very alive, very juicy and very witty and very sexy and all the rest of it. So I hope that intelligent children will enjoy them, and young adults, and people who remember them dimly from school and remember liking some of those stories and wanting to be reacquainted with them. I mean, I sort of wrote it for myself when I was 14, perhaps.
This is so interesting because there's nothing on it that says this is for young adults or this is a YA book or...
Yeah.
But in a way, that's where you've pitched it?
I think so, but I hope an adult wouldn't find it in any way talking down to them or too simple or simplistic. I suppose I was going between the ones I already knew that... I grew up with, there were some great American myth tellers. There's Edith Hamilton, who's one of the greatest. I think she was absolutely brilliant and wrote a number of books on myth. And there were the Nathaniel Hawthorne, you know, the great, you know, as in The Scarlet Letter. And he wrote Tanglewood Tales and the Golden, what was it called? The Golden Something. It was a second volume anyway. And those were very much for children. And Edith Hamilton for young adults, probably, I suppose you'd say. And then... the ones most British people like me grew up with, Robert Graves. And he was almost comically scholarly. You know, it was little paragraphs and huge numbers of footnotes. And he was also incredibly keen on proving his own particular points of mythography rather than mythology, if you like. He liked to trace things back to their Sumerian and Akkadian and Babylonian roots and even further back and see it as a whole sort of process. He was particularly obsessed with his white goddess. He wrote a book, if you remember, called The White Goddess. And that was a bit too grown up and a bit too sort of academic or sort of almost scholiastic. So I just tried to write something that I felt was in a space that hadn't really been filled, I suppose.
And it's your 10th book. I mean, we think of you
as
a comedian.
Right?
Yeah,
goodness.
I counted them all up.
Goodness.
There are 10 of them.
Wow.
What's next? It sounds as if it has to be Genesis. Are you going to take on the Bible?
That's an interesting thought.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Guardian Books Podcast. Since the Odyssey first appeared in English around 400 years ago, the story of the Greek warrior king has prompted some 60 English translations. Amazingly, Emily Wilson's is the very first by a woman. The Guardian's Charlotte Higgins, herself a former classics scholar, met Emily and began by asking her whether she set out to forge a particularly feminist version of the Odyssey.
It actually wasn't my primary thought at the start. I mean, so when I was first asked to do this project by Norton, I first thought, I mean, if I knew a little bit about the current translations that people usually read and usually prescribe in undergraduate classes when students are reading the Odyssey. And I dipped into them a bit more and realized that one of the big things I felt I wanted to do differently was about style, that I wanted to use iambic pentameter and I wanted to draw on my both deep knowledge of and deep love of the English Anglophone poetic tradition, and that I felt I wanted to create an English Homer that would be genuinely sort of immersed in that verse tradition and come across as somehow or other whatever real poetry is, that would feel like real poetry, but also that would have some element of weirdness, magicalness about it. So I was thinking a lot about style when I started out. And it was only as I went on with the poem and I started thinking harder about how am I going to deal with this scene, that scene, how am I going to make that character come alive, this character come alive, I started to realize more and more that I wanted to bring out all the different elements in the story and the ways that it's a story which I think is focalized through multiple different characters. There's a tendency to read the Odyssey in this very simplifying way as just the story of proto-white good guy Odysseus, and he's successful, gets back with his objectified wife and gets his slaves back and gets back all his consumer goods. That's a happy ending. And just to make sure that my translation showed that, in fact, that's not a good reading of the text. And that, in fact, there's a roundedness to each of the characters, including the ones who are presented as maybe not quite human or maybe not quite male enough. And that there are ways to make the text come alive by showing how diverse it is and by showing how many voices there are. So I think that's both about gender, but also about other kinds of social roles.
I wanted to ask you, Emily, if we could, when you're talking about style, whether we could start to hear a bit of both Homer's style. I wondered if you could read the first few lines of the poem in Greek and then hear the same few lines in English.
Sure, absolutely, yes. So I'm going to read, I guess, just the first five lines, and it's in dactylic hexameter in Homeric Greek. So I hope you'll hear the rhythm a little bit. Andra moi ennepe musa polutropon hos malapolla plankthe epe troyes hieron toliethron epersen polon d'anthropon idenastia kai noen egno Πόλα το γεν ποντό παθενάλγια, χον καταθούμον, αρνουμενος χέντε ψυκέν καί νοστόν χιτάιρον.
It was lovely. Much better than I could summon up in this day and age, I can tell you that for free. Bit rusty on the old dactylic hexameter in Greek.
All right, so here's the old iambic pentameter in English. Book one, The Boy and the Goddess. Tell me about a complicated man. Muse, tell me how he wandered and was lost when he had wrecked the holy town of Troy, and where he went and who he met, the pain he suffered in the storms at sea, and how he worked to save his life and bring his men back home. He failed to keep them safe. Poor fools, they ate the sun god's cattle, and the god kept them from home. Now, goddess, child of Zeus, tell the old story for our modern times. Find the beginning.
One thing that I think really comes out of your translation is this sort of sense of the kind of polyphonic nature of it. It's not just this man, this husband's story. It's a very rich text in which there are other characters who are also complicated and who have kind of moments in the limelight and add the sort of extraordinary richness to the epic. I wonder if there are any of those characters that you particularly enjoyed translating or found layers in that you hadn't expected to or hadn't read in other translations.
I mean, I guess just in terms of characters I loved, I mean, the whole thing was really a fun project. It's not like I can really limit myself.
Did you have a kind of... how many? There's 24 books of about 500 to 600 lines each. That is, my maths is terrible, but that's a lot of lines.
How many lines? I mean, so I think I used to try sometimes to set myself a certain number of lines in a day, and that didn't really work because sometimes I would spend a week on a single word, and then sometimes it was just coming along really well. And it also got a lot easier as it went on. I mean, the first year or so of working on it was extremely difficult, and I felt I wasn't quite finding my voice yet, and I had to go back and revise. But then the last few books, it came so much more easily because I felt I'm in a rhythm. I've got the idea of what kind of voice and what tone I want. I had a way of doing it.
So I deflected you from talking about these characters, fun scenes and characters.
There are lots. I mean, since you launched with the fact that I'm the first woman to publish a translation into English, I think we should go with a female character. How about Helen? We could go with her. Should we do that?
So yes, Helen of Troy.
And of Sparta. So the whole problem that she's both of Troy and of Sparta is obviously part of it, yes. The hostess with the mostess, and as everybody knows, this is a poem about hospitality, which in Greek is xenia, and we get xenophobia and the sadly less common xenophilia. And so she's a hostess in a way that's very unusual for a female character, because most female characters don't get to move around. So they don't get to be in another person's house and be a guest as well as a host. So there's something sort of strange in itself about a female host.
And also she insists on speaking. Mm-hmm. Shall I remain silent or shall I give voice to my thoughts? And she doesn't wait for an answer. She just speaks, which is interesting in this poem because that doesn't always happen, does it?
It doesn't always happen. I mean, I think it's a poem in which there's a repeated trope of women being silenced or else of female voices being seen as dangerous, female orifices, female voices. So Penelope, Odysseus' wife, is twice shut up by Telemachus, on two significant occasions, both early on and then later on in the poem, Telemachus tries to shut her up and sends her back upstairs to be with the women. And then when Odysseus is on his wanderings, apart from the giant characters, the Laestrygonians and the Cyclopes, most of the dangers that he encounters are females who very often are dangerous because they speak too much, or their voices are dangerous, or their mouths are dangerous. Scylla, of course, has six dangerous mouths. Charybdis, the whirlpool, is all dangerous mouth. The Sirens obviously have very dangerous speaking voices.
So they sing and entrap
the men who are fool enough to stay and listen to female voices are going to wither away. So there's this whole focus on trying to shut up women because otherwise they're going to trap you or wither you away. And I guess another crucial moment in all of this is that women can shut up women too. That Penelope, very importantly, shuts up her slave who's been like her daughter, Melantho. She shuts her up, and then later Melantho, along with 11 of her peers, gets hanged by Telemachus, which is another very definitive way to shut up a woman, to prevent her having further voices.
Well, by killing her.
By killing her.
Pretty definitive.
By killing her, but not just any old killing. The fact that it's strangulation, it's focused on the throat, on the voice. That the Melantho has been speaking out of turn, and this is going to prevent her from any further voice.
So Helen is in a kind of separate category in a way. Helen has got an extraordinary power. And I think that shows the suppleness of the poem, actually, that it allows, right, it's not just a kind of hideous, misogynist poem. It's actually kind of very flexible and interesting in that way.
Exactly. And then it allows Helen to be, it's a super attractive character. It's not that she's presented as evil because she's speaking and she's much smarter than her husband, she's much more assertive. She's actually seems very impressive, and she seems in many ways like Odysseus himself, in that she's so much in control of appearances and disguises, and she has this uncanny ability to see through people.
I have to say, from other translations into English of this poem, you wouldn't always get quite that picture, because there's a word which we'll talk about how you translated it in a minute, but there's a word, Canopus, which literally means dog face or dog eyed, and it's one of those slightly mysterious words in Greek, like what it actually means, what force it has. It's something that you put together from context of where it actually appears, isn't it? It's not absolutely obvious, and yet in most English translations it is translated as things like bitch or whore, even?
No, I don't know. I haven't read all the English translations, but I know that Stephen Mitchell translates it as bitch. He has her say, bitch that I am. And more commonly, in the translations I've looked at, it's translated as shameless, which of course doesn't have any aspect of the metaphor in it. Neither has the dog thing or the face thing. So one could say, just on those grounds, it's not a very good translation. And it also seems to me problematic in that it doesn't fit with the overall characterization of Helen in book four, that she would be calling herself shameless or a bitch, or saying the Trojan War was caused by my shamelessness, which seems like a very dubious claim.
Or bitchiness.
Right, or my bitchiness.
I'm such a bitch.
Yes.
Right. It caused the Trojan War.
Yes.
So just remind us how you translated that line.
So what she says is, Kunopidos henek emoyo, which literally means for the sake of me being Dogface. So I think we should pause not just on the Dogface thing, which is a very rare word usually applied to goddesses, and it's applied by Euripides to the Furies. It's not a word of nearly as common as bitch, or even as common as shameless. It's a rare word which I think suggests that it's to do with a gaze that doesn't let go. A dog can have that, and a fury can have that. And then also just to think a little bit about what is it to do something for the sake of something that is something. So were they making war for the sake of her because they thought she was dog face, whatever that means. So what I did with it is I make her say, they made my face the cause that hounded them.
Which is quite different.
It's quite different. But it keeps the metaphor. And I think it sort of teases out the elements that are there in a more... I mean, it both has the dog, has the face, and has the question of causation in the line. And I think those three elements are crucial to the Greek and not actually reflected in most translations.
And do you think it's a kind of unreflexive masculinist reading that makes one come up with shameless and bitch? I mean, what's
yes,
going on
there? I do. I mean, certainly with things like bitch. I mean, certainly with, and we can talk also at other scenes where there's an... You launched with saying mine is a feminist translation, which I think some people are going to get their heckles up about that. I mean, they might. I hope it's not everybody on the Guardian podcast. But, but there may be people who think, oh, she's importing her own ideology onto the text. Why doesn't she just translate it? And I hear what you're saying, but I think that's a misapprehension about what translation is. If you don't think about what your prejudices are, what your ideology is, what interpretation you're coming with, then you're going to come up with just importing your ideology without thinking about it, as opposed to doing it while you're thinking about it. So, for instance, Stephen Mitchell makes her call herself a bitch. I don't think he's really thought through all the things that I just said about the particular usage of that word. Another good example, I think, is the later scene, which Ray already referred to, where Telemachus hangs the 12 slave women. Most translators don't call them slaves. They call them maids. And very often they call them the disobedient maids. And the majority of translations that I've looked at import abusive language, which isn't there in the Greek. So, for instance, the Richmond Latimer translation calls them those creatures. And the best-selling Robert Fagel's translation has Telemachus say to them, you sluts, you whores. And both those words are not, and there's nothing equivalent to that in the Greek. What the Greek says literally is, those who spent the night beside the suitors. So I make it more literal. And you could say that's feminist, or you could just say that's not being as masculinist as the dominant way of translating that scene.
It's completely brilliant. The scales have fallen off my eyes, I have to say. It's a long time since I've read this poem in Greek, I'm afraid to say. But I've read it a few times in the Fagel's translation, and reading your, which I love, I mean, I love it. Reading your translation was just like reading a new poem. It was amazing. There were just all kinds of things that I hadn't noticed before. It was wonderful.
That's so sweet.
Well, that's all we have time for this week. Many thanks to Emily Wilson, Charlotte Higgins and Stephen Fry. Emily Wilson's translation of the Odyssey is published by W.W. Norton, and Stephen Fry's Mythos, a retelling of the myths of ancient Greece, is published by Michael Joseph. Next week, we'll be canvassing book recommendations for 2017 from all our star contributors and taking a look at another momentous year with a seven in it, 1947, with Elizabeth Osbrink, the author of a new book devoted to it. Was it, as her subtitle suggests, the year where now begins? Listen in to find out. In the meantime, you can join the discussion on Twitter at Guardian Books or on the Guardian website. Just search for Guardian Books Podcast, which is also how you'll find us in your favourite podcast app. But for now, from me, Claire Armistead, and our producer, Simon Barnard, goodbye and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.